Welcome. This is Navigating the Clouds with an Enterprise IT Strategy. I am Fred Miller. I'm from Furman University, as are my co-presenters here. To my left is Clayton Burton, who's a web programmer analyst at Furman University. And to his left is Clayton Burton, who's a senior programmer analyst. And we're going to be taking turns going through some of these slides, talking about some of the things we're are prepared to present, and I'm going to get right into it. Just a little overview of the agenda. We're going to talk a little bit about IT strategic planning in the cloud. We're going to talk about the various cloud models and their roles in the strategy. We'll talk quite a bit about identity management, and that can tie your cloud strategy together. And we're going to go a little bit into Shibboleth, and finally wrap up with some lessons learned and future considerations. And I have some poll questions here, and this is my backup in case the polls don't work. So let's go right to the first one. This is our test poll, and there we go. This is Poll Everywhere. If you have a mobile device, computer, you can go to pollev.com/fmiller and respond to our poll. Okay, and let's see, basically, do you use cloud computing beyond email and calendar? I know today we had campus computing survey results and some very interesting things there about cloud computing. So if you would respond to our poll now, that would be a good thing. And people who are online can also respond at pollev.com/fmiller. And you can also, if you just have a phone and want to text an answer, that's what those two numbers are the number you can use as a text. You just text to 37607, one of those two numbers, and that will help with our poll. So quite a number of people who are responding, and it looks like, it's almost 3-1 using cloud now beyond email and calendar, and that's a good thing. Matter of fact, I did get a chance to talk with Casey Green a little bit, and of course his concern is he says people are now going for the low-hanging fruit, and they haven't really gone to the ERP. And we have not moved our ERP, but we found an awful lot of those low-hanging fruit. It really is an orchard out there. So a little bit about Furman University. We are a private liberal arts university, 750 acres in Greenville, South Carolina, moving up to about 2,700 students. It is a southern university. We do have academic rigor, southern grace, and a commitment to service. There are three ways that I like to describe the university. And I've been learning the southern grace, so bear with me if I seem a little bit rushed. I'm originally from the Northeast, and I've been trying to figure all that out in terms of culture. And when it comes to strategy, I do want to talk a little bit about culture. Those of you that heard Bill Hoag speak today mentioned that culture can eat strategy for breakfast. And so I want to talk a little bit about how culture affects our strategy. Just one more quick question before we start moving through slides. How many of you have a strategy for what should be hosted in the cloud versus what's on campus? If you respond to this, that'd be very helpful. No strategy. Cloud first, yes, depends. And again, you can text to 37607. And we're getting no strategy, still in the lead. And cloud first is kind of trailing, but it depends. I think we're probably depends as well. Though I think we're heading towards the cloud first, but it really at this point does depend. So thank you all very much for, and I think Casey Green said that it was, it's actually kind of high here because his numbers said that in higher ed, it was 27% of higher education institutions have a cloud strategy. So we're doing pretty good in this room and also the people who are listening and responding from the internet. So I want to talk a bit about Furman's technology strategic plans. When I started at Furman in 2008, there was a 50-page IT strategic plan in place, and buried in there, there was goal 2-24.2, establish efficient central system, and one of the points for that was implement single sign-on. No mention of the cloud back in 2007. We had a new president start, and we did another strategic plan. This time, I figured 50 pages, nobody's going to read that. We boiled it down to a one-page executive summary, 3 pages of the plan, and then about a dozen pages of supporting documents, charts, figures core data survey was not included in the public version of the plan. But in there, we did have one sentence talking about enable efficient operations and appropriate vendor operations using appropriate vendor cloud and open source solutions. So we've continued to build on our cloud solutions. And one of the tactics we're using now is SAML 2.0 for cloud authentication using single sign-on. I'm not going to go too much on this. I think we've heard a lot about how vendors now are marketing not just to IT departments, but they're marketing to our students, faculty, and staff. They're marketing to individual departments. It's just a diagram showing the environment we're working in. You want to call it consumerization, you can. That's what we're dealing with. So when we talk about cloud in terms of strategy, we realize that there are risks involved in using cloud computing. Security, of course, is one of the big risks. And when I talk to our financial people, when I talk to our board of trustees, I try and use this slide, which is adapted from one that developed by the MIT Center for Information Systems Research, and it talks about thinking about IT as an investment. And just like a financial investment, if you want to get the best returns on your portfolio, you want to have some risk in that portfolio. If all you make is conservative investments, you won't get as good a return as those people, those organizations, institutions that take some risks. And MIT CS, this group says most of IT investment, not just in higher ed, but in all technology organizations, most of the investments in infrastructure, a good amount of investment in transaction processing, analytics on top of that. And then most IT organizations spend roughly 15% on average on terms of strategic investments. The best IT organizations spend 20%. The really top ones can spend up to about 25%. So if you wonder what kind of things that are going on with strategic investments outside of higher ed, that's a good rule of thumb, I think. The thing to remember, though, is that when we talk about strategic investments, those are the most risky. And the MIT CISR group, they put together this slide talking about risk, saying that when you do these strategic investments, you have to realize, and I hate to use this, but they say, expect about 50% of these things you're trying are going to fail. That's why there's risk. But when those ones that hit are going to really pay back big time. So transaction processing, we've been doing that for years, lowest risk. Analytics, not so much risk. Infrastructure, because when we put it in, it's going to last quite a number of years. It's our hope. There's some risk there. If you make the wrong choice and have to pull it out before you expect it, that's where the risk is. And the strategic innovations, again, is what we consider where we're investing a lot in terms of our strategic investment for cloud computing. My co-presenters here have told me that I sometimes spend a little bit too much time on this slide talking about best practices. So I'm going to try and get through this one, because I know I've been to a few cloud presentations, and you probably have too, where they made the point, really make sure IT is seen as a partner, not a competitor. That's very important. I mentioned the Southern culture, trying to have some Southern grace. I've really been trying to reach out to our departments and let them know that we're here to help, and that we're not trying to stand in their way. Yes, we do want to ask some questions about what they're trying to do. We do worry about risk. We do worry about compliance. But we want to make sure it gets done right. One of the things we do to help that process, I'm very grateful, the university. I know at a larger university it's very difficult to do. But at Furman University, we do have a policy that says all technology purchases or leases for hardware, software, and services must have the approval of the chief information officer. That's been very helpful, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. Compliance reviews, PCI is a big one. How many of you have PCI on your campus, payment card industry? Okay, that's one of the first things we put in the cloud. We don't do payment card industry. There's no payment card industry data on our campus. It doesn't touch us. It goes through a cloud provider. Most important, having leadership on board with this approach has been very helpful. For example, when I explained to the chief financial officer the risks involved in having payment card industry data on our campus network, she suddenly became a believer. Okay, let's have this not be on our network. And when I talked to the people at Nakubo and their chief, the person they have there that talks about PCI, and I told them what we're doing, he says, that's the way to do it. So happy we're moving that way. Another thing we're trying to do in terms of the culture, and I think this is one of the things in higher education that we've been doing a lot, is talking about a culture of assessment. And what we do, again, this was recommended by that MIT group, we call it post-implementation reviews, where we actually go and say, okay, we spent a lot of time putting a new system in, let's take some time and let's see how it works. Can we do it better? Some people might come to us and say, hey, we found this great cloud solution, we want to put it in, replace what we have now. We say, okay, well, what lessons have you learned from the system you have now? So it's a little step back, could spend a whole session just talking about post-implementation reviews, and we may do that in the future, but I'm going to move on from this slide. This is our vision, one place to get all your Furman stuff. Everything you see on there is just there's the major things. We do most of our Moodle's on campus, but we do have a Moodle server in the cloud. We have Office 365, OrgSync Box, and a lot more that I'm going to talk about. This is our portal. Everything in the top right corner is single sign-on, most of it cloud. I'm going to show you a little bit more of that as we talk about the difference between software as a service and cloud as a kit. That's a Microsoft data center, by the way. It's very hard to beat that kind of scale, especially an institution our size. Cloud as a kit is a University of California, Berkeley term from their computer science department talking about software as a service. They call it cloud as a kit. That graph there tries to talk about, for example, if we have a server that we have on campus, we try and size it for peak. When it's not being used at peak, the rest, it sits idle. And of course, that's how Amazon got into the business, was they wanted to say, gee, we've got all these spare computes sitting around, can we make some money off of it? Your software as a service vendors are doing the same thing for you. They give you one price and say, here's what you're going to pay, and they're turning around and using infrastructure as a service, and I'll talk to you about that. So. Software as a service is pretty much like we do the old traditional server model where you pay for your peak. And there's some lessons to be learned there. Office 365, Box, all software as a service. This is a slide showing some of the vendors we use for software as a service now at Furman. And if you see the yellow boxes, those are all vendors that we use single sign-on with. They all use one of our single sign-on techniques, various flavors of SAML. We'll talk about how we're trying to go to Shibboleth in the future, but I'm not endorsing all these, just letting you know these are some of the ones you may recognize that we use at Furman. Infrastructure as a service is very interesting. Like I said, I know a lot of our vendors are using this model. They're using Amazon. We're starting to use Amazon as well. We're using it for a Moodle instance for various external programs that we host for our campus, and we also use it for this digital magazine, which if you want to take a look at, it's edge.furman.edu. It is HTML5, responsive design. It is running on Amazon's cloud. The nice thing is if we're going to send out a promotion about the magazine, we ramp up the services on Amazon so it can have more hits, and if once that's done, we can ramp it down, and we're charged by how much data actually gets moved. So if we don't have much activity going on, we don't get charged as much. It's working out pretty well for us. So I'm going to move on now to a couple of questions and then turn it over to one of my co-presenters. Okay, infrastructure as a service. I know many of us use software as a service. I'd like to know how many of you, and if you do, what are you using it for? So you can actually text I know research is one, development. How many of you use some kind of infrastructure service, like you go to Amazon and rent servers directly? Anybody out there? Is it pretty much just software as a service, or anybody in the room, anybody on the internet doing infrastructure as a service? QA environments, okay. None. Development, yep, good, good. No. Offsite backups, okay, really good. Yeah, look at all, that's kind of hard. A lot of no's coming in. So not, yes, starting to test for load balancing. Okay, testing, excellent. DR for main web. Yeah, we're actually looking for our main website as well. We actually just kicked off in September an HTML5 responsive website that runs on SharePoint. It's now running on our campus servers, but of course we're saying, well, gee, that's kind of silly. Most of our audience is off campus. We should go and put it somewhere in the cloud. and that would be on infrastructure as a service. So I'm going to turn it over now to Jason Long, who's going to talk a little bit about our identity management in the cloud, and he's going to talk about our strategy, the portal, a little bit about Shibboleth, and one place for all your campus stuff, and risks and costs and that sort of thing. But before we move over to there, we have one more poll. And this one says, do you have a campus single sign-on? And if you do, do you use it with the cloud? So Jason, you want to take it from here while we're seeing the answers?
Hi, I'm Jason Long, like Fred said. And looks like the majority of people do have a single sign-on and are using it for cloud-based services. So that's pretty cool. That's definitely who we're talking to. All right, so when it comes to single sign-on, there's a lot of motivations for why you would do it. And I know a lot of people have heard a lot of this already at the conference. Consumers are expecting it. You can log into CNN with Facebook, for instance. I mean, they come to your campus and they expect that that's what's going to be. There's better usability when you've only got one centralized location for people to remember. The provisioning can be done a lot easier for all these services. If you have true single sign-on, then it's hopefully auto-provisioning, so you only keep track of one user store and it goes out to all the others automatically, and it allows you to have better user access control. So when you have the person who's being escorted to the parking lot at 2 o'clock on a Wednesday, you can shut down their user access in one place and they can no longer log in to all the other services. Also, and the most important thing for us, is that third-party services never see our passwords. So when you have something like Box or Microsoft, who are big targets, if they ever got compromised, nobody's getting your password to get to all of your other services. Unfortunately, there's also risks associated with it as well. Yeah, that's a good one, isn't it? The 1Password is obviously a liability, and we've talked a lot in this conference about possibly having multi-factor authentication. There's also a structural failure point. When you have everything logging in through one server, that server better stay up, or else your constituents are going to have a hard time logging in. I also just put less direct control, but really risk in general when it comes to the cloud is kind of a matter of we don't even really know what all we don't know when it comes to risks. There's not a lot of data publicly available. There's not a lot of studies that I know of comparing, say, Amazon to your own local institution and which one is more secure. Obviously, both sides are rather reticent to give up that information, but it's what it comes down to is how much risk are you willing to take on and how much you're comfortable with. So when it comes to single sign-on choices, there are a lot of them. I call them standard resistant. They kind of remind me of web standards in that there are a lot of different people kind of doing something similar. They're mostly on the same page. They don't always get along. And of course, Microsoft is off doing their own thing. And it's not just services you plan on using. That's the other thing, too. As Fred mentioned, the different departments are being marketed to directly by vendors, so you don't necessarily know what's going to be coming to your door. Additional considerations include things like your entire staff model is changing from managing systems to managing services, and you have to work more with contracts instead of actual boxes in-house. You got to decide whether or not you're going to train up your own staff or if you're going to bring in other people, whether or not you want to make sure you can support a wide range of services, which allows lots of people to be happy, but it may strain your time and resources, or if you want to focus more in on narrow support, which may frustrate some users. Also, there's a real architecture cost, and there's been at least one other presentation talking about this, but single sign-on isn't just like, hey, it's great and everything's done in the cloud and you don't have to worry about it. Yeah, you still have to anchor those connections, and those anchors better be really good. So we're talking about real hardware costs. The way Furman has gone about doing all this, originally, this is our original setup, and it kind of grew organically, and it's sort of messy, and we didn't really have what you could really call single sign-on. It's really more of same sign-on. But this happened because we were doing things rapidly and we needed things to work when we needed them to work. And we didn't have a lot of in-house knowledge about how this all was supposed to go. What we're working toward is something so simple a child could use it. But the idea here is that you log into one thing on top to SharePoint, you go all the way down to the bottom, all the way back up, and it's all seamless, and you're logged into all the services, or you can log into all the services that you need to be able to log into. This is one of the most important slides that I have shown, so if you don't remember anything else from my part of the presentation, remember this. And one key little thing, too, one of the differences here is SharePoint 2010 versus SharePoint 2007. This kind of setup really requires SharePoint 2010. Additional things that are part of Furman's choices include using vendors to help supplement in-house knowledge while simultaneously trying to shore up our staff knowledge, just because we needed to have something really quickly. We're going from that organic spread out model to that child's toy all in multiple steps, and that's where we're still heading. And as part of that consolidation, obviously, as I said before, one of the problems is when one of those pieces in that child's toy fails, that's not good for everybody. So you really have to build up the architecture and make sure you have a lot of redundancy and horsepower to really support that. But our two big bets really are Shibboleth and the InCommon network. Really, we believe that that's where things are going to go. So now I have some questions for folks. These are the previews of the questions. And the first one is coming up now. Do you allow cloud vendors to store your user passwords? Hopefully this is a softball. And yes, but we'd rather not. Yeah, I see. But yeah, and while I am waiting on this question, I will switch over to my co-presenter, Clayton Burton.
Hey, everyone. My name is Clayton, and let's move on to the second question, or I guess there's only one with that poll. I'm here to tell you where Shibboleths come from. I'm one of the programmers at Furman, and I was involved with the original setup of SAML, which we were in a very much rush to do, and we actually used Fisher International, who's here at EDUCAUSE, to help get that up and running quickly, and ever since then, I've been trying to understand what we did. And Shibboleth is one implementation of the SAML standard. The L in SAML stands for language, and it's primarily for two different kinds of servers to talk to each other, speaking SAML. And these two servers are basically servers that do something useful and servers that know who you are. A typical conversation between these servers, which are the service provider servers and the identity provider servers, are the service provider will say to the identity provider, tell me about person X. And the identity provider will then turn around and say, I assert, and that is the A in SAML, that this person is this, this, and this. And at that point in time, the identity provider server authenticates that this person is who they say they are, and also can share some other information to the service provider, and that can help with auto-provisioning accounts. That's another thing you can do with SAML. The primary benefit to Furman for using SAML and Shibboleth is for this web SSO profile. And a secondary benefit is the ability to move those different data attributes. So, are you using an Internet 2 service or another Shibboleth-based service at your institution? So there we go. With Shibboleth and EDUCAUSE folks, you can be part of the InCommon Federation. And federations are a big part of SAML, or can be. It can make setup a lot easier and can add some security to the system. So clearly not a necessity, but it looks like a fair number of folks do. Let's see. So for a look into under the hood of SAML, SAML stands for Security Assertion Markup Language. And it was put together by a company that was founded in 1993 called SGML Open. SGML, some of you may recognize, the standard generic markup language. That's the language from which HTML and XML were derived. And this company, SGML Open, changed their name and became Oasis in the late 90s. I believe it was 98. And Oasis is the one which is the current holder of the SAML specs. So the folks that are putting out the standard for SAML, that's them. And we're in 2.0 right now. It's the latest. And these are, if you look into the standards, if you look into the specs, this is the kind of thing you see. And the piece which is by far the most important for Furman is this web browser SSO profile. There are lots of other things you can do with the system, but that's the biggie. And I'm going to take you through a quick showcase of what this is like, what the SAML workflow for the web SSO bit looks like. For starters, a user using a web browser will go to a site that offers something useful to a service provider, and they're wanting a specific service. This is where they're wanting to fetch their email, or they're wanting to upload or download a file from a storage service like Box. And if this is their first time this session talking to that service provider, the service provider turns around and needs to talk to the identity provider. This uses what you call a front channel communication. There's no direct communication between these two, between the service provider and the identity provider. All the messages go or pass back and forth through the web browser. And so it sends what equates to a permission slip to the web browser and says redirect over to the IDP page. And at that point, once the IDP gets that request, your web browser is redirected there. If you haven't signed on before, your IDP will challenge you and say, hey, who are you? Give me your username and your password. If you're already signed in, this just blips by. You may notice your web browser flicker for a second as it goes through two or so redirects. But this is a part of the single sign-on, which is the single sign-on. And once you've convinced the identity provider server that you are who you say you are, then it sends you back over to the service provider, which then finally gives you the resource that you were after in the first place. And seeing all together, this is the long way. So there are a few technicalities. There are a few interesting technical challenges that you run into throughout this process that the standard addresses. One of which you'll see reference to is WAIF. That is where you from, so what it stands for. And this is for defining this red line here. So you're at the service provider, and you know Box.com. They have dozens, hundreds, tons of different folks, different institutions they deal with, and of course many, many individual users. And to know which identity provider to send you to, that's what the WAIF business is all about. Another component of the SAML system is metadata. This is usually provided by your federation if you're part of a federation like in common. If you're not part of a federation, then actually you're given some metadata to store on your identity provider server. And there's not that much interesting stuff in there, really. You'll find public keys for use that adds security, so that the IDP and the SP know exactly who they're talking to. And it helps. This helps you bring new service providers on board more easily. If they're part of the federation, then the entity ID of their servers is out there in the metadata of InCommon. And everyone can find the metadata for InCommon. It's somewhere around 8 megs or so. It's a big XML file, which you can Google up. And a few other considerations whenever you're working with SAML Web SSO is log out. So imagine you go to your portal. You sign in. You're now singly signed in. You click onto a service such as Box or email. You do what you need to do. And then on that service, you click log out. Well, what does that log out mean? A lot of times, that just means it signs you out of that particular service. You're signed out of Box. Technically, that means something. Practically, it means almost nothing. Because you're still signed in to your SSO. You're still signed in to your portal. So even though you've signed out a box, if you get up and leave the computer, if you come back, you're still, if someone else comes back to where you were, you've not only, all they need to do is click on the link to box again and they're signed back in. That SSO is still in business, is still has you signed in. Also for clustering this stuff, Shibboleth, and when you're trying to add redundancy to this, the Shibboleth system doesn't have anything inherently to support clustering. That turns out not to be such a big deal because of the way the SSO works, but it's a consideration. And whenever you're standing up the Shibboleth server, that you're going to have every one of your sign ons go through, you do need to set up redundant servers. And there's a couple of different ways of going about that, which are outside of the scope of Shibboleth. And two-factor authentication is another thing, which is not directly supported, but the MFA is one group which is looking into that. So with that, I'll turn it over to Fred.
Okay, thank you for our deep dive into the Shibboleth internals. I'm going to bring it back a little bit to the strategic level. Talk a little bit about some of the lessons we've learned. Certainly being able to identify the risks helps when we're talking with our partners on campus about their choices, again, as they're being marketed to by all these vendors. As Clayton mentioned with the logout problem, we've been taking a lot of time to educate our campus community. We even have a little video out there now about security practices we do ask everybody to take a look at. And managing change. I remember when I first told our faculty meeting that we were going to be going to Office 365 and that email was going to be in the cloud. I guess this has to do with educating the community as well. But one of the faculty members stood up and says, now tell me, Fred, where is this cloud? So leadership support is also key. Pictured there is our interim president, Carl Court, and somebody who's been most helpful in with our moving towards best practices, and that's our Vice President for Business and Finance, Mary Lou Merkt. And really, their support has helped us think about digital platforms so that we can talk to people about, okay, that's a solution for your department, but let's have a conversation about what would be best for the university. And having that conversation helps build the trust that is needed not just with you and your vendor, but your IT department and others in the university. Now, talking about strategy, this is a little framework we found helpful at Furman University, is to try and present a conversation framed this way in terms of two different ways of looking at a problem. So we could be looking at cloud services, and one way to think of the cloud service is cloud services are great for innovation. Another way to look at it is what it's better to have the servers on campus for security. Two diametrically opposed positions. Another position, of course, we see this a lot between the large institutions and the smaller, is the support. Do you want to have support for at your department level? Are they going to be doing support for all these various systems? Or would it be better if you had some coordinated support? I know at Furman we had that discussion a few years ago. We moved everything out of departments, where the departments had some servers under the desks, and we brought everything back to our data center and virtualized it. So people understood, oh my goodness, I thought it would be better if it was in the department, but you all are doing a great job. You promised that you'd have this level of service and you're delivering it. So I'm just presenting this to you for you to consider as one way when you talk about it on campus to think about where does your campus want to be? What would it be like? What kind of scenarios? What stories can you tell if you were going to cloud services for innovation but you had distributed support? So for example, if you're going to have a single sign-on solution, will that work in a scenario where you have distributed support? I think at Furman, we're probably heading more towards that number two, where support is coordinated and we are looking at cloud services for innovation. So this is just something for you to think about. It's a framework for presenting these kind of ideas when you're talking to your various campus governance groups. So just want to wrap it up now, have a sort of a final question here. How long before all campus services are in the cloud? I think we've got it right here. So here it comes. What do you think? All campus services, is it ever going to happen? Within 3 years, 3 to 5 years, 5 to 10, more than 10, or after I retire? Yeah, it makes me sort of think sometimes about, what's that Malcolm Gladwell book, The Tipping Point. Back a few, I think it was just 2 years ago, Casey Green reported that only 7% of institutions were doing any kind of cloud services. So things have really moved, and it may be that these things happen faster than we think. I think Casey's thinking that 3 to 5 years, but I think most of us are thinking more than 10 years. So just to let you know, some of the things we're thinking about for Furman in terms of challenges and opportunities, more mobility. How does this, we obviously want to present these solutions in the cloud to our campus in a mobile environment. How does it work for virtualization? We're actually in a project right now, I know many of you are already doing virtual desktop, and we're doing it now on campus, but at some point, are we going to want to host that? I suspect it probably has to do with how well we beef up our internet connection. That's obviously a concern. If you have this, all the servers off campus, you better have a pretty good and redundant internet connection. We're looking for ways to collaborate with other institutions. It's great that we have the Internet 2 and Net Plus. We use them for Box. Not sure that they're always right for us. We're doing a test right now of, what's their backup solution called? Yeah, Crash Plan Pro. And I'm just looking at the pricing for an institution our size to go through Internet 2, and they're going to have to work on that a little bit. It works pretty well if we do it ourselves, and the setup costs from the internet too just aren't geared for an institution firm in size, so they need to work on that. So the question is, what's right? When to collaborate? When to partner? These are all things we're looking for. I think it's great that we have resources like EDUCAUSE where we can all get together and talk about some of these common problems, some trying to figure out what our challenges are, what are our opportunities. And I want to thank you so much for coming here today, because this is a great opportunity for us to talk about these challenges and these opportunities. And at the moment right now, I want to thank you. I do have a couple links up here. You're going to be able to download the slides after. But we do have time, this was intentional, to entertain some questions. And if you'd rather present your question online, that's okay too, but we do have the microphones in the room as well. So thank you all once again, and now it's time. If you have questions, happy to hear. Is it just that it's Thursday and it's just like I'm done?
I think we're just that thorough.
Oh, we're just that good. Well, let me thank you all once again. I very much appreciate your attention, and hope that we can work together to advance the cloud computing, mobility, and I also want to thank EDUCAUSE for this opportunity. You all are EDUCAUSE. I'm EDUCAUSE, you're EDUCAUSE. Please contribute. It's by our working together that we're going to be able to advance higher education, so thank you very much. Data backup in cloud or on premise. Right now we